The Soul Jazz Orchestra with People from their album Manifesto. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lee, and we are continuing our adventure into looking deeply into the news and finding, of course, that invariably what we are told is the news is very different from what the news actually is. And the discussions we've been having, I am very proud to say, are at a level that not even seasoned reporters are engaging in communicating to the public just really what is at stake in any given story. What is the real core of the story? It's not just the simple facts of when a thing happened, who it happened to, and the results of it, but we're talking about analytical thinking, where you go beyond what you see as the facts, and you start thinking about how the situation presents a number of other things that we routinely ignore. We just don't go there. We wait for the news people, those in authority, to tell us what the story is. When, as you look at it, as you've been listening, I hope, to callers, ordinary, I mean, nobody's graduated from journalism school, all of that, and perhaps that's the good side of it. When you stop and you think about something in as many dimensions as you can, you invariably find that you are operating at a whole different level. And so a story means something very different to you than it does to the masses of people who are fed, the standard pap. Who, what, when, where, why, and how. But when you start thinking about interrelationships of facts and you start getting deeper into a story, you see how entirely different the story becomes. And how much on a daily basis we are deprived of real information about the world we live in. All right. So we continue with our theme. I have a number of stories that we never did get to just yet. And I want to try this one out on you to ask you what you're thinking about this particular story. A teenager in Alabama is suing an abortion clinic for terminating the life of his unborn child against his wishes. On Tuesday, 2 days ago, an Alabama county court recognized the aborted fetus, given a name of Baby Roe, as a plaintiff in the lawsuit. And so this lawsuit becomes something most unusual, the first of its kind, in which an unborn fetus, an aborted fetus, as a matter of fact, is being represented in a case where the allegation is the abortion was, in fact, the termination of his right to life. Now, what's intriguing about that is that the plaintiff is a male, young teenager, Ryan Majors, I think is it's pronounced. said that his girlfriend got an abortion against his wishes, and that he had demanded that she not terminate the pregnancy. But she did so anyway, violating not only his desire to be a father, but also the child's entitlement to life. Now, that's a very interesting case for many reasons, which, of course, you will tell us. Why is this so intriguing? Why is this such an unusual position to take? And what are we to think about this particular approach where the state of Alabama recognizes a fetus as entitled to life? How does that square against what we have been conditioned to believe is that the rights of the parents, and specifically the mother giving birth, or the mother having the abortion, has greater rights? Who has greater rights here? Is it a question of just plain old who has more rights than others? A right to life in this case? Is it unusual that a young man is going to be taking this position that he was entitled to be a father? He was entitled to have this baby born. The normal opinion is, well, it's a decision that the mother usually takes charge of this decision. And everybody defers to the mother, but this is not the case. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. I want to know from you what you think is the significance of this case, and how would it possibly impact not, only people in Alabama, but across the country. And what does it say about this whole business of right to life? When the state ultimately exercises the ultimate power and decides who is right and who is wrong in this case, or who has rights and who does not have rights in this case, how do we square this all up? Again, the young man involved is 18 years old, and he took this action to express his view that his desire to have this pregnancy come to completion, he had a right to that, irrespective of what anybody else says. He had a right also to have a child, even if others did not see it that way. What are you thinking? Fakir of New Jersey, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Latrice. I really
Good
don't.
afternoon.
I'm a first-time caller, and
Great.
I tried desperately to get in yesterday because it's the subject nobody spoke on the things that I was thinking about. And if I may, what I was thinking about is there a precedent that young lady who went over to work with ISIS, is there a precedent of people doing that and coming back to the United States? I recall a young man went over to work to join the Taliban, and he came back. I believe he lived in California, and he came back and he was living in California. Also, I recall Patty Hearst, who joined the organization, even though she was kidnapped in the beginning. She joined the Civil Liberty, how you say that?
Symbionese Liberation Army.
Yes, she joined that organization, and she was it was a terrorist organization. And she's living a good life now back in her native country. I mean, she never left, but she's living a good life. But those two points I didn't hear anyone bring up. And I like I said, I tried desperately to get in yesterday, and I couldn't.
That's all right. I'm glad that you called again. But, you know, I think you overlooked some very important points, and it's called context. In the case of Patty Hearst, what would you say is the most important context in that case?
She was rich and she was a Caucasian.
Thank you. Thank you. End of story.
Okay, but the other guy who joined the Taliban, I don't believe he was rich. He was a Caucasian, but I don't believe he was rich. He might have been middle class. But mm-hmm. I understand those two points that you're making. But those are prejudice. When you go to court, they say, is there prejudice for this case? And those are two people.
There may not be precedent for the case, because with the passage of time, you also have the passage, a difference in attitude by the government and by the people. In the time of Patty Hearst, for example, it was unusual, and it was a high profile case and so forth, but I don't think that the case resonated as much, because the Symbionese Liberation Army, up until that time, was largely an organization in name. It had not racked up the reputation, say, of ISIS. They were in formation, and they were contemplating doing some radical things and so forth, and committing acts of violence. But the Symbionese Liberation Army, up until the time that Patty Hearst announced her affiliation with it, really wasn't in the news much. They were in formation, and largely, I would say, and I'm not trying to diminish the stature of this political organization, but they were in formation. This is a situation in which you have the organization ISIS being globally recognized as a terrorist organization. We saw the pictures of what they would do or could do. We saw the results of their so-called handiwork. This was not a make-believe organization. This was a serious organization. And the other aspect of it, which was unusual, was that most of the people joining ISIS, at least to public knowledge, were men, not women. So that was extraordinary.
Yes. But Latrice, the government considered the organization a terrorist organization. Hello, are you still there?
Yes, I'm listening.
Okay, the government considered the organization a terrorist organization, right?
Yes. But not in the way that we consider terrorist organizations today. Look, a lot of it had to do more with, at the time when you had these so-called terrorist organizations emerging, they were largely people of color and sympathetic whites, radical whites. Either way, what we came to know of these organizations was cast in a negative light. These are crazy people trying to take over the United States and kill everybody. That's the simplistic presentation that we got. But nonetheless, we were conditioned by it. You know,
well,
I don't know if you remember, you had to have seen that photograph of Patty Hearst shortly after the bank heist with her beret and her, you know, machine gun. And,
yeah.
You know, that it was public relations. Patty Hearst wasn't prepared to kill anybody.
Okay, if you say the organization that she belonged to wasn't the same as we have today, what about the Taliban? What about the American who went to join the Taliban and he's back in this country right now?
Yes, but that's more recent. These are more recent developments, and we have learned to take these organizations very seriously because they were very careful in communicating to the world how serious they are about achieving their goals. Before,
okay.
You know, even though the FBI and security agencies, national security agencies, made us believe, of course, that these were serious people, I don't think you can say that the nation reacted accordingly, saying, well, oh, they're very serious, and we are under direct threat. I don't think that that was the mindset of the nation as a whole. The mindset of the nation as a whole was that, you know, these are young people, you know, sowing their oats, and they're pretending that they're serious, and they're pretending that they're revolutionaries. But we didn't take them as seriously as the Taliban today or the ISIS today. Or any of the radical groups, even if they were small, you know, we take them seriously today.
I see the Taliban today just as just as much the same as it was when this country went over there and invaded their country and bombed them, and they caught this guy and brought him back. He was an American. The only difference
yes.
I see between him and the woman that they're talking about today is that she's a person of color. They both did the identical same thing. They both joined groups that the American deemed to be terrorist groups that are a threat to the security of the United States. But he got a different type of treatment than she did.
Well, and it is to be expected because a large part, don't forget, in the time that we're in, a large part of the effort is to propagandize, to use any particular situation to the advantage of the side that is in control or has captured somebody, or, you know, you use that kind of public relations, if you will, to tell people, look, they may be very, very serious people, but we caught them. Or here in the case of the young woman, oh, she talked big stuff and she wanted to go and be with ISIS and all of that stuff. But sooner or later, we have her pleading to come back. We have her admitting that she made a mistake and she wants the life that she had but did not appreciate. And besides which, she's not an American, not in the way that we should consider Americans. She is not an American. She's the daughter of a Yemeni former diplomat, even though she was born in the United States. She is something other than American. So that's great grist for the mill. And you use that to great advantage. You captured somebody. You didn't even have to capture them. Things were so bad with this group. She was facing such an awful prospect in life that she was begging to come back home.
So that's the only reason why they're saying that she can't come back, because she's not truly an American, even though she was born.
No, I'm saying these are the things that are floated out to the public to condition the public to not have sympathy. And on the flip side of that coin, to shore up the propaganda, of course, that the United States, even though people want to attack it, they really do want. They really do understand, and they come to a point they come to a conclusion that life, this is not a good life. It's a better life in the United States as an American.
Of course.
There you go.
He made a mistake, and so did Patty Hearst make a mistake. And
but Patty Hearst was a member of the elite class.
Yes,
and it wasn't really a mistake. It was just an adventure. She embarked on a misadventure, I should say.
Yes. But if you look at the word terrorist, whether she's a big terrorist or a little terrorist, whether the world recognizes the Seminese Liberation Army as a little terrorist and ISIS as a big terrorist, a terrorist is a terrorist.
That's according to you and me, but that's not according to the government. Remember, there are two different narratives going on here. For all we know, the Symbionese Liberation Army was not at all prepared to undertake an operation of any significance, but they made it appear so. The Black Panther Party, the Black Panthers probably could not have undertaken an operation of the scope that they were talking about, but they made it appear so. You see? And so we have always, especially in an ideological fight, this was not just military, it was ideological. You have all kinds of factors at play, but mostly, who is going to win the sympathies of the people? Who was going to win the support of the people? Who would the people would believe, the government or these groups that are trying to do to bring about justice and equality? They tried it. It didn't work.
I thought if we went by the rule of law and you had a president, whereas it happened before, and they can use that argument in court.
Yeah, except I hope you recognize how far off the mark you already are. What is the rule of law? Who has the rule of law? Who gets to determine the rule of law? And that is a function, again, of persuading masses of people. Look what's happening in Venezuela. Who has the rule of law? Even the president elected, the duly elected president of the Republic of Venezuela, he's not seen as having control or the rule of law on his side. Even though he has it. Technically, he has it. He was elected, and he is the president of the country. But then you have a renegade group getting the United States to stand behind them and promise and vow to support them to the bitter end, meaning the U.S. has set the stage, even psychologically, that the current elected president is not the guy who should run the country. It doesn't matter what the people think.
He has the unfortunate situation of being in a country that has more oil than Saudi Arabia.
It's more than that. It's more than that.
I'm just saying that he has the unfortunate situation of being in a country that has so much oil. Because the United States is less about the people of Venezuela.
But we are dismissing, and we should not do so. We should also pay attention to what you could forecast down the road. This is a kind of ethnic cleansing that is going on in Venezuela.
Yes. They said 3/4 of the population are African, Indian, of African, Indian descent. And the minority wants to run the country. Like in
You cannot have, it will not be tolerated in this world, racist world, where you have people who are occupying positions of power and control over strategic resources who are not white. So it's going to spread inevitably, you know, it will have a ripple effect. And both the quality and the color of leadership in Central and South America will change. You would see it becoming more and more white. Don't forget, I mean, I'm blocking on his name now. I'll get it in a minute. These things are happening to me now. Where you have the president of the country being encouraged by the people to be called mono, meaning monkey. And you have the current president of the United States making it very clear. These are countries that should continue to exist only if they serve a purpose to the United States interests and the money elite, the power elite. So there's a lot going on at the same time, which is why it is important to dissect the news so you can see how things are developing and why they're going in that particular direction. That is what is happening all over the world. I thank you for calling and getting us started today, Fakir. And let's hear from you again soon. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes, Eutrice, I want to take a look at that first proposal that you made with the young man going to court. And as I look at it, in a different way. I think that women in those cases, like the abortion and whatnot, women should have charge of their own bodies. I believe that whatever judge is taking this case, he's giving standing to this young man who shouldn't have any standing at all in the case of a woman deciding what she wants to do with her body. So there's something else going on here then. That means that it sounds like there's a political decision to open the door to something that never should be opened. This young man who thinks he's the father of this child, maybe or maybe not, to me, should be considered someone you dismiss because I think he has no standing. The woman ought to be able to make her own decision about what she does with her body.
But the question is, why is it that the male, this is part of the rationale here, why is it that the woman gets total unilateral rights to decide? If it took two people to create a being, Are we to just dismiss out of hand that the male has nothing other than, nothing other, no other contribution than donation of sperm? And that's all, and, you know, he could get lost after that. He has no claim to fatherhood. He has no right to expect that he would have some kind of input and responsibility in the creation and the growth of a child.
Well, I think that whoever this young man is, or any young man in that situation, can communicate with the potential mother, the mother of whatever child that she's going to have. And that's good. But I think the main decision should come from the woman in terms of being in control of her body, and not having the situation where the male has veto power over what women do with their bodies.
You see, this is the interesting contradiction. We're living in a society, and I'm not being, you know, saying I'm pro or against. I'm saying we're looking at it from a point of view of long-term, how do you create a society? Do you create a society as, and the intention is that you have like the hive, the queen bee doing all the egg laying and essentially controlling the life and longevity of a hive, and the drones are just there to impregnate the queen, and that job is done. Do we dare conceive, pardon the pun, the idea of a society in which people who want, who like the idea of a family living in a particular way as a family, do we have room for that, or do we just cancel that out?
Well, I'm not against families, even though I still stand on what I think women should have the right to their own health care and making decisions like this woman made. And that's why I said that I believe that the male in this case, I don't think should have standing in a case like
Ooh.
This.
That's rough. Okay. Well, let me ask you this then. Why do we need co-parenting? Why do we need male and female? I mean, why don't we organize society differently based on what we really believe? There is no need. If the idea is the important person in the responsibility of giving birth to children, raising children, and so forth, is the female, is that not itself sexist? And does that not deprive a man of his right to be a parent, to participate in parenting?
Well, that brings up, you know, another situation where there are situations where when a child is born, there's a falling out between the parents, and in some hostile situations, the one parent will squeeze the other parent out from having anything to do with the child. that I think that happens quite often, who with people who carry so much animus against the other parent, that that happens, and I think that's wrong. But
of course it's wrong. Of course it's wrong. But at the same time, and you're right, it's not the majority of situations that end up that way. And B, even if you had that going, it still does not address the question of what are the rights of a father to his progeny. And this is not a guy trying to run away. This is a guy trying to involve himself. But the state, and I know we can suspect that that particular statute came about because of the influence, the very powerful influence of the Christian right.
Mm-hmm.
They decided how these things could go. I'm trying to figure out, how do we get to a place where we make sensible decisions, not religious decisions so as such, or ideological decisions? This is a matter of a family unit. And even if the man does not want to involve himself in raising a family, raising a child, that does not mean that he should automatically lose that right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're opening up a new door now with a case like this, and that has to be looked at as a possibility of new law in this case, because I don't think there's anything that we have right now that makes that possible. Maybe as a society, some people would want to do that, even though I basically think that women should control their bodies. But the situation now is that many people are not getting married. Lots of women are having children. I guess maybe half the children born are born to single mothers. So I don't know. I think that's an area that could be investigated and looked at as a possibility of making some changes in that. But as it stands right at this minute, I see it as the woman having control of her body.
Okay. Thank you so much. You make your points well. Ed from Queens, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Ed. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
I wanted to speak to the previous caller's point he was raising about that abortion case with the woman and the young man that wanted to claim responsibility. I tend to disagree, and I'm not against, I'm not a right to life, or I'm not against a woman's right to choose or control of her own body. But it takes two people to create an individual. It takes a contribution from the male and a contribution from the female. Even though the contribution from the female is a much more physically sizable one, with certain individuals, there's emotion involved, for myself particularly and other people that I know. And there might be a desire on the male's part to support the child and want to be involved. I mean, notoriously, men have been left out of the picture when it comes to this discussion. And there's some prejudices involved in it. And there's a lot of emotions that come involved, emotional concerns, otherwise. But I believe that a male should have some rights pertaining to whether a child is created or not. I don't think that men should be totally shut out of the picture if they're so inclined to be involved. But it's a difficult topic because, like I said, notoriously, men have foreshortened this responsibility throughout the years. And since the woman makes such a large physical contribution to the actual birth of a child, it tends to make a gray area. But I don't think if a man is sincere and a man is truly interested, he should have some say in the process.
I think that is kind of condescending. We don't typically say, well, in a case of a pregnancy, we should really ask the female, the woman, to tell us or to give indications as to whether she wants to have the child or not. The automatic assumption is she will be the mother of the child. But in our society, according to this law now in Alabama, they're fighting to make it, of course, to spread it wider than the Alabama. Why is it that it is automatically assumed that if any of the parties, either of the parties, is to fail at parenting, it would be the male?
I mean, historically, it's a bias, like I said. Unfortunately, throughout history, men have not been considered the responsible parent. The woman has always been considered the responsible parent, the nurturer, because of the large physical investment that is made in having a child. And unfortunately, in Western society, the nurturing part, the rearing of the child, predominantly falls to the mother. I mean, and especially in this society, the concept of family is totally changed. There is no more male-female standard model of parenting or family orientation. I mean, you have LGBT, you have single parents, you have people that opt for different types of family and living situations that have totally changed the quote-unquote moral aspect or usual aspect of looking at a family. But what I'm saying is that when it comes to the birth of a child, I believe a man should have some say in whether or not the child is brought on the earth, if he is, for want of a better word, sincere about being a parent, and shows that sincerity, shows that that stalwartness, that he will be available, and he will be responsible for the birth. It shouldn't just be a decision that is left up to the mother.
But you're saying everything except it is not to be assumed that he automatically has rights. That he has to pretty much fill out a form and see if he could get some rights to his own child.
Well, should you have to prove your rights? I mean, are rights something? I thought rights were given by nature, you know, like the Constitution says, we have some inalienable rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. If maybe having a child would be a male's consideration as far as being in his right to have the pursuit of happiness, the continuation of his lineage, for want of a better word.
It doesn't bother you that this particular aspect of human rights will now be a factor of, you know, the court. The court will be involved in determining who is permitted to exercise the right of fatherhood.
Well, no, I'm not comfortable with that idea. I mean, I think it should be like inalienable human rights. Your right to live, your right to pursue a quality and a style of life. I believe it should be constant. You know what I mean? I don't think you should have to have that adjudicated. I think that should be your rights.
Well, you see, it's developing interestingly, because all of a sudden, I'm sure you're thinking, I never thought about this before. I never had to think about this.
Actually, stuff I before. Never really have, but when the other caller was discussing it, I mean, I have always had feelings about it as far as pertaining to abortion and who can make the final decision. Like I said, there's a lot of historic evidence that men are not responsible when it comes to rearing of children. And throughout the ages, you know, the conquering male comes and has relations with the women and sort of leaves and the child, bastardized child, and so on, things of that nature. But I believe there are some men, I mean, I'm one of them, who have a sincere investment, a sincere desire to have a child. And I would like to have a say in the final decision, because I plan to be responsible for my participation in the endeavor.
This final decision, mm-hmm. In this final decision, there's one person who doesn't have a say, and that's the baby.
That's it.
Okay. Is that fair? If it is that people are going
then you're getting into the whole debate of when does life start? Conception.
Well, this is where the court is entering now, because this young man's petition to the court says that not only is he entitled to decide whether this pregnancy comes full term, but the child, even though the child can't speak and can't see and can't do a lot of things, the child as a human being has inherent rights to life. Who is in charge of protecting that child's inherent right to life? That's the question.
Well, that's a deeper issue, because then you've got to get into, when does life begin? I mean, does it begin at the moment of conception? Does it begin when the cells start to divide? Is there a point to where you can establish, okay, this is going to be a conscious human being? I mean, you get into a lot of debates of philosophical, religious, and biological things that come into account. I mean, who's to say? You know, that's a difficult thing to adjudicate.
I would say so. But in the end, we still must answer the question. Does the child have a right to life, regardless?
I mean, that's a tough one. Emotionally, I think, yeah, everybody's got a right to life, no matter what, because you don't know what this person will become. Good, bad, or indifferent, everyone has a right to live and survive. But when does that life become a life? When can we? Is it when you have the germ of consciousness? Is it when there's a certain amount of chromosomes? Is it after, you know, after so many cellular divisions, first trimester, second trimester? I mean, when? What are we? We'd have to quantify life, and that's difficult.
Well, but we have evidence that quote the law has already decided these questions, irrespective of what you and I and others feel. The law has made a decision about a lot of these things. The question is, in this scenario where a young man insists that he's entitled to be a father, which means that the child has to continue to exist. You can't have arbitrary abortion. Mm-hmm. If you have a father who insists that he has a right. So I don't know where we go with it, but it is a very deep question, as you say. Thanks for calling in and contributing. Tom from Connecticut,
thank you.
You're on the air.
Hi, Trace.
Hi.
I was quite stunned that this has never come up before.
No.
And, you know, to contemplate the fact that someone would want to step up and say, you know, this could be my child too. If you don't want it, it seemed like she might have done this without his knowledge, let alone his consent, to where he could have said, well, no, I want to be its father. Why are you doing this? It's a very curious dynamic. Like I said, I was really stunned that this has never come up before. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I mean, you know, the courts pretty much decide a whole bunch of things in our lives that we prefer that they don't. But it's just very odd. And yet, I think it needs to be something that's resolved, and there needs to be some kind of public discussion about this. Because I'm sure he's not the only person out there that was disappointed that they lost a child with no, you know, recourse or no ability to say, I'll be its father if you don't want to be its mother.
But then again, you have the other questions that arise, including, should the state be involved in deciding who gets to be a parent and who does not get to be a parent?
Well, they should have, tests to see who's going to be. you're contemplating having a child. You have to come in and take a very detailed test to see if we deem you appropriate to be parents.
Yeah, that's where it's going. Don't you see it? It's going that way where the decision of parenthood would be regulated. And it has already been in the case of this young man. He has been denied, this is his argument, he has been denied, summarily denied, the right to be a father. And the consideration of parenthood, or even whether the child lives, is 100% in the hands of the mother. Is that fair? Is that right? Is that moral?
Well, I, having first heard this, it struck me to say, like, why? Why shouldn't he have an equal right in trying to decide, since this could be his child just as easily as hers, that he would have some say in the matter? And it'll be very curious to see how this plays out. I would side with the guy, really. I mean, somebody wants to step up in a society where, like the gentleman mentioned earlier, men are kind of deemed the people that run away and leave fatherless children, that someone would want to step up and take responsibility and be a parent. What do you do with those folks? You know, it's like I said, I would side with the guy. There should be some forum for him to make a case to say, I want to be the child's father.
Well, he did that by getting the woman pregnant. That was a decision.
They made that decision. And there was intent to have a child.
Right. The burden of responsibility, curiously, does not seem to be with her. Because the court seems to have automatically decided she is a mother, and that's that.
Well, I didn't read the details of his pleading to see, you know, what details were in play, but yeah, intent to be parents, I mean, that's really not the case in many instances, for sure. But if they mutually decided that they were engaging in, you know, making a child, and then all of a sudden she doesn't want it, there's several layers to this that are just very compelling, and you have to see where it goes. And once again, in what state, in what venue, how these things will be heard, who will be hearing it, where will it go?
And all of this becomes an unnecessary set of complications to what we assume would be, you know, regular. I come from a family of nine. I hate to think what could have happened. You know.
Oh, wow.
So,
I take it as being a very compelling issue, and I would side in with the guy at this point.
Well, I'm not so much siding with the guy. I am siding against the state. The state should have no business in this. So we have to come up with a system that makes sense and that is practical. Because what we will end up doing, as in this case, you have to accept the overarching supervision and decision of the state over what we commonly believe is a personal right. And that is crazy. Soon again, like you said, you'll have to submit applications and be approved ahead of time. Thanks so much for calling. And that brings us to the end of our program today. We'll meet up again tomorrow for Free Your Mind Friday. Bye-bye.